Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. You are listening to NABWIC Talks Radio. Thank you for joining us this morning. Today we have a special program laid out for you. What we have done is we've went back into our archives and we've designed a show centered around assisting our NABWIC listeners to either increase their business or stay in business. And how we're going to start this program off is with the founder of the National Association of Black Women in Construction, Ms. Ann McNeil. She will share with us the vision and the mission statement of the National Association of Black Women in Construction and exactly what this organization sets out to do and how we plan to accomplish doing that. So she's going to start us off this morning with the vision and the mission statement for the National Association of Black Women in Construction. And then we're going to hear from someone. She's going to give us some advice of her experience. She's been in the business for over 25 years. Ms. Gloria Carney Sheely. She is the president and CEO of the Danielle Corporation, which is located in North Carolina and also has a presence in South Carolina as well. So we're going to hear from her pearls of wisdom as to basically if you would like to get started in the construction industry, how an individual can go about doing that. And also, once you do get started, her experience with the Danielle Corporation of how to navigate the ups and downs in this economy. So we have Ms. Gloria Sheely up as well, so we can look forward to that. In addition, we have Ms. Lisa Colin Herring. She is a lawyer from Southern Florida. She's going to share with us some of the things to look out for when it comes to a contract, because we're all interested in getting those contracts, because that's how we make our revenue in this business. So she's going to share with us some points as to what to look out for in a contract, and that's essential, and also what benefits having an attorney on the team can provide when looking at contracts. So she's going to be on the program as well coming up. And then we're going to close our program with some information from the Small Business Administration with regard to Hub Zone, the Hub Zone program, historically underutilized business program. So it's a way to get certified, particularly to get some additional business from the United States government. And so just a way to align ourselves or put ourselves in position to get those contracts if we do qualify for the Hub Zone program. So this program is full of information. You may just want to get a pen and pencil out. Remember, this program, as well as the excerpts of this program, are from archives programs on the show, NABWIC Talks Radio. Also, too, NABWIC.org. You can go there, NABWIC.org. Follow the link to Blog Talk, and you can hear this broadcast live, or you can get the archived version of this broadcast by following that link at NABWIC.org. So let's get started today. Again, we're going to hear from Ms. Ann McNeil, the founder of the National Association of Black Women in Construction, first. Ann?
Good morning, and this is Ann McNeil coming to you from West Palm Beach, Florida, on behalf of the National Association for Black Women in Construction. We are the voice of Black Women in Construction. And as the voice of Black Women in Construction, our vision is to help African-American young girls in junior high school, and colleges to consider coming into the construction industry. And today, our show is going to basically share with our listening audience a little about the organization, why we were founded, what our goals and our vision and our aspirations are, and how we can help add value to the construction industry. And at this time, what I'd like to do is to just give you a little history about how this organization was started. This is Ann McNeil, and as the first African-American female contractor in the state of Florida, I travel a lot, and as I travel, I would see many African-American females in key positions and key roles in the private sector and also in the public sector. And as a result, we would talk, but there would always only be maybe one. One here, one there, but not very many of us. And then the same as we would go out and we would speak to young students, mostly African-American schools, and the girls would look at us and think, I could never do that. I could never walk around and wear a hard hat and get dirty and be in that business? Well, in that business for many of us includes wearing a suit. It includes wearing a hard hat. It includes being an architect, an engineer, or whatever it is that you choose you want to be. But when you think about the construction industry as a whole, normally it has been designated as an area for mostly white males. But as we continue to populate this industry, we continue to realize that there are opportunities in every single area of this industry for us as African Americans and also just as people in general. Our vision was founded on the purpose of increasing the national awareness of African American women in the construction industry. The charge of the National Association of Black Women in Construction is to advocate for black women to further increase the opportunities of our members. Our mission is to build upon a solid foundation, strengthening the building blocks of black women in construction by identifying new educational, entrepreneurial, professional, and social gateways throughout the world. Our vision is to build lasting strategic partnerships with first-rate organizations and individuals that will provide groundbreaking and innovative solutions for black women in this construction industry and also in our respective communities. Our goals are to recognize and support black women in the industry. We also strive to foster partnerships between our chapters and other industry-related organizations. We will seek and achieve corporate partnerships and business opportunities for our members. That's a member benefit. We will also encourage and enhance educational opportunities for black women interested in construction careers. We'll also establish scholarships and programs for high-achieving young black women who are looking to obtain a college degree in the fields of construction, engineering, architecture, in the areas of transportation, and many other industries. We also provide community service programs, such as One House at a Time, which is by providing industry-efficient upgrades in homes that are located in low-income areas. Faith in Action is another program that we have, which allows us to provide handyman services, drivers, and home care to low-income and elderly individuals. To just share with our listening audience a little bit about who we are, what we do, and how we intend to do that. So, as I was saying, though, we also look at providing networking opportunities for black women to meet and support as we network with our members. And also, we also network with other people in the construction industry. Now, the strategies by which we will employ this is that we partner with other organizations in the industry, whether it's Hispanic, women, white, race neutral. If it's construction and construction related, we are looking at participating in the industry with those individuals. Now, in order to achieve this, we do have membership chapters throughout the United States. And if you are interested in participating in any of our activities, you can reach us by emailing us at info@nabwic.org, or you can visit our website at www.nabwic.org.
Thank you, Ann, for getting us started this morning. And next up, we have Ms. Gloria Carney Shealy. She is the president and CEO of the Danielle Company, which is an organization out of North Carolina with a presence in South Carolina. And Ms. Gloria Carney Shealy is also the president of the National Association of Minority Contractors. So let's listen as she shares with us what a company would need to do to get started in the construction industry. And also, after she shares her take on that, we're also going to ask her, with these rough economic times that we've experienced, how has the Danielle Company managed to stay in business? So let's take a listen from the excerpt from the interview with Ms. Gloria Carney Shealy.
So So what advice would you give to others who want to start a construction business?
There are a number of things, and this is hard work, and this is a tough business, so it's not for everyone. So I would first say, if you do not have a passion for construction or any particular trade within construction, this may not be the path for you. But if you do, then the first thing that I would say is prepare exhaustively. Make sure that you have done your homework and your due diligence in terms of the market that you're looking to serve in terms of the area of expertise that you see as your niche. Identify where the resources are for that. Organize for excellence in the workflows and the processes that you will need, and put the right people in the right place. And once you sort of get those pieces together, make sure you've got on the front end, you've built in an abundant capital resource base or cash flow base that allows you to do the groundwork before you get that first contract. And once you do, you want to make sure that you are prepared to execute flawlessly and consistently and glean from the best practices of other successful companies. You do not need to recreate the wheel. There are many that have been in this business and been in it for a long time successfully. So glean from them. And then, make a policy that you're going to exceed expectations. The way that you get additional business is aligned with how you've done on the last project that you completed. And you want to always strategize to anticipate the unexpected or, be strategic in responding to the unexpected. In construction, things happen, always. It never goes perfectly. So you want to always anticipate as much as possible, but when you find yourself having to resolve a situation or an issue, you want to be strategic and very responsive in how you address that. Make sure that you've got a great support network around you. This is a industry that requires a lot of hands and minds to be involved, to be successful. And so having a team attitude and approach and being able to pull all the different pieces that you need to have in play is very, very important in understanding what those are.
Great. I appreciate those points. Having that team attitude is essential in construction because it doesn't take one person. It takes an entire team to get any structure built, and everyone has their different areas of expertise. The Danielle Company is a minority-owned business. How do you think you were able to survive in such an economy?
I think a primary benefit to us was our approach of relationships, so that where we were not doing what we call one-offs, we were very selective about which relationships we engaged, and we were very selective even within those relationships which projects that made sense for us. So we had a willingness to say no, but we also had demonstrated our capability and capacity early on, which allowed us to build that pipeline. And we were able to successfully build that pipeline. Certainly when the economic downturn came, that pipeline, at a point towards the end, became very, very slim. And we did the same things that everyone else did because we could see it gave us a little bit longer window, not much, but just a little bit longer window to reset by streamlining. And streamlining for excellence, that meant if both streamlining expenses or costs, but also streamlining people resources, because we knew that in order for us to be continue to be competitive, we had to take out some of the excess. So mediocrity has never been acceptable for us. But if you were on borderline between excellence and mediocrity, we no longer had that luxury. You had to be excellent, and so we drew the line and reset and begin to retool with some of the right people that we needed. And so that was very, very helpful. But having the long-term relationship where the repeat business, so to speak, was built in based on our ability to nurture and deliver allowed us to sustain. And we're all continuing to recover, just like everyone else. We are in recovery mode. We've been very, very fortunate. We're on the uptick, and God has been good and blessed us. But it has been with great challenge for us, just like everyone else.
Thank you, Gloria. We appreciate you taking the time to share that information with us. And next up, we have Ms. Lisa Colin Herring. She is an attorney from Southern California, and she's going to share with us some things to look for in a contract once we get those contracts that we so eagerly pursue, and basically how to protect ourselves and what to look out for. So, Lisa?
And these are the top five, what I call top five contract clauses that you really should be aware of, because this is where many of the troubles can occur. And people take them for granted, so it's very it's good to outline them and know what they are. So if I can just go down the list, my top five are what's called the slow down and incorporation by reference clause, the payment clause, the changes clause, the indemnification clause, and the termination clause. And if you want me to, I can just go through briefly each of these and give tips of what to look for in your contract.
Yes, please do. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for the slow down and incorporation by reference clause, all of these will apply whether you are the prime contractor, the sub-sub, or even the supplier if you're working under a purchase order. If you are the prime contractor, you have a contract directly with the owner. Usually your contract will call for you to slow down or to have in your subcontracts some of the clauses that the owner wants in your contract. So, for example, if the owner wants you to submit your payment within 15 days, they may want you to slow that provision down to your subcontractor. You have to know, when you're the sub, you have to know that this provision exists in the prime contract. And if you're the prime contractor, you have to make sure that your subcontracts, with all of your subcontractors, have these provisions so that you're complying, because if you're not complying, you could be in breach of your prime contract. If you're the subcontractor and you have a flow-down clause or incorporation by reference clause, meaning that the prime contract is incorporated by reference in your subcontract, then you need to look for, read the prime contract. So you need to ask the prime contractor or ask the owner to give you a copy of the prime contract. You would not believe how many subcontractors have a clause that says the prime contract is incorporated by reference, but they've never looked at the prime contract. Doing just simple stuff like this, just tying up the loose ends before you begin the work, is very important. So get a copy of that prime contract and read it and look for inconsistencies in your subcontract. And this is where having an attorney on your team can be very helpful. The flow-down clause may require you to slow down all of these rights. So if you are the prime, you want to make sure that you're doing so, so that you're not in breach of the contract. Another clause that's very important is the payment clause. Of course, everybody's in business to get paid and to make money and hopefully make a profit. So you need to make sure that you understand how your payment clause works. For example, you want to make sure that your payment clause, you understand what's the timing of getting paid. So, for example, you want to make sure that you're using the right payment application and you're submitting it on time, and that you understand how long you're going to have to wait to get paid. Also, you want to make sure that you doing your schedule of values, if your contract so requires, and that you have the appropriate releases. All contracts, I've not seen a construction contract that does not require you to submit partial releases of either lien rights or bond rights before you get your payment. So you have to make sure that you're understanding that. And one of the most important things and a very hot topic ish right now is pay when pay clauses. And just, I'm not going to go into a lengthy sermon on pay when pay clause because we can spend a whole half an hour just talking about that. But in general, a lot of subcontracts will have a clause that says that the subcontractor doesn't get paid from the contractor until the owner makes payment. You want to make sure that if your contract has this clause, that you really understand what that means and you really know how to protect yourself and make sure that you are protecting your lien rights and protecting your bond rights. A next clause that you should be aware of is the changes clause. And this is basically a clause that would tell you that the owner has the right to make changes of the project. And you need to know what to do if the owner requests a change in the project. You need to know what are your rights and what are your obligations to do that change. A lot of times a lot of litigation stems from change orders. That's when the owner requests additional work or the subcontractor or the contractor comes across a condition that was not foreseen and they have to do additional work and they put in a request to be paid for that work. Well, a lot of the times people don't stop a project just to negotiate the changes. So you have to know how to protect yourself and what are your obligations. You have the right to stop work before until the owner or the contractor, the prime contractor, agrees to pay you for the work, or do you have a continued obligation to continue working? So knowing this clause and how it works, knowing the notice provisions, how much time you have to give to the owner, and how to present that claim to the owner is very important. The next clause I want to talk about is the indemnification clause and how that works. Indemnification clause basically will say that if you or one of your workers or one of your subcontractors causes someone to be injured or causes damage to the property or to the work that's being performed, then you'll be required to defend either the owner or the prime contractor and indemnify that person if that person sustains any losses. So if someone gets hurt on the project and they bring because of your negligence and they bring an action against the owner, you're going to have to step in and pay to indemnify that owner, pay them, sometimes even defend their lawsuit. So it's very important. You need to look out for broad form indemnifications clauses. There are some clauses that talk about having the subcontractor or the prime contractor indemnify the owner even for the owner's negligence, depending on what state you're working in, that may be legal, or it may not be legal. So you have to really look for that kind of language. And most important when you're looking at an indemnification clause is to go to your insurance agent and sit with him or her and really make sure that you have the correct insurance coverages. Enough insurance coverage to cover an indemnification clause. So that's really the takeaway there. And finally, what I want to talk about is termination clause. Hopefully, when we go into a project, everyone will hope that the project ends up well and that you leave, you get paid, and you have a good relationship either with the owner or the prime contractor. But sometimes that doesn't always occur. And you either you as the prime or the sub needs to terminate your contract, or the owner may have rights to terminate in certain instances. You need to read your contract and know what are those instances. Some people don't know that if the owner finds you insolvent, that if you file for bankruptcy or you have a receiver take over your business, that could trigger termination of your contract. Even though that your financial wherewithal may not have anything to do with the project that you're doing. So you have to know that that's there. Try to negotiate that out if that's a concern to you. So take a look at the reasons for the termination. Also, you want to know how you get paid if you get terminated. Some contracts call for the owner having the right to keep your equipment. When they terminate you and continue the work. So you really need to know what you may face if you get into a fight with an owner or a contractor for termination. And lastly, I want to talk about termination for convenience because this clause is always in a public contract. And basically, it gives the owner the right to terminate you for any any reason whatsoever, at the will, at the convenience of the owner. And so you have to know that if you're going into a project and you're allocating your resources to a particular project and you have a termination for convenience cause, I think that's something that you need to know and be very aware of. And you need to know how, if you do get terminated for convenience, how to put together your claim for payment. But that will often, more often than not, allow you to recover for your overhead and your lost profits. And so those are basically some of the five clauses that are important and that I'd work with my clients in helping them to understand, to recognize, and to be aware of, and to know how the risk shifts to them. Because a lot of the times, the further down in the totem pole you are, the more burden that you take on and the more risk, unfortunately, you have, and the less money and the less profit margin you have. So small contractors are really being squeezed in this economy. And so it's all the tools that you can have to protect yourself, you need to take advantage of it.
Wow, thank you, Lisa.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Lisa. And next up, we're going to hear from Mariana Pardue from the Small Business Administration. She is the director of the Hub Zone, and she's going to give us some information on the historically underutilized business program and how companies can take advantage of that program, putting themselves in line for government contracts if they qualify. So, Mariana?
So we've mentioned it a couple of times already,
yes.
But let's fill our listeners in on exactly what the Hub Zone program is and how they can benefit.
Sure. The Hub Zone program is the only program, federal program of its kind, that provides federal contracts that to be set aside for businesses located and employing people from the poorest areas of the country. The program was created back in the late 90s. As a way of assisting areas that had been devastated for generations. These are areas that have not just responded to a downturn of the economy or the crisis that we went through about 4 years ago, you know. But these are areas that some of them are devastated by the lack of industry in their call Hub Zone, and Hub Zone stands for Historically Underutilized Business Zones. So it's HUB Zone. Some people confuse it with HUD, you know, the Housing and Urban Development, but this is HUB, Historically Underutilized Business Zones. And so there are areas throughout the country. So, for example, we have qualified census tracts. These are census tracts that, because of their poverty rate, are qualified as Hub Zones. So these are sprinkled throughout the country, whether it's in a metro county or a non-metro county. Then we have entire counties, non-metropolitan counties, that qualified as Hub Zones, depending on their unemployment rate and also the median household income. We also have Indian Country. Indian Country qualifies as Hub Zone in its entirety. And we also have the bases that have been closed under the Realignment Act. So when a base closes under a Realignment Act, they become a Hub Zone only for a period of 5 years from the time it closes, and then it doesn't get renewed. Indian Country is always a Hub Zone. It does not expire. And the non-metro counties that I was mentioning and the qualified census tracts, they're reevaluated periodically. So, for example, for non-metropolitan counties, every year we receive data of unemployment and median household income. So every year we reevaluate these counties. And when a county loses designation as Hub Zone, that means that they're doing a little bit better. It doesn't mean that they're doing wonderful, but they're not doing as bad as they did in order to qualify, obviously, as historically underutilized business zone. So whenever they lose, the non-metro areas, they lose this qualification, this designation as Hub Zone, they remain designated for 3 additional years to prepare the businesses for basically just
not longer being HubZone designated, or to prepare them to reallocate resources. And I know we're going to talk a little bit later on what a business can do, you know, to continue the certification. Same thing with the qualified census tracts that I mentioned earlier. We do the qualified census tracts, actually, HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, does the analysis for that. And so they do the analysis every 5 years. So they did an analysis that we just implemented October 1st, and they'll do the next one in 2018. And when a qualified census tract loses designation because they're doing a little bit better, but maybe they don't have as much the poverty level, obviously, that they had, then they remain redesignated for 3 additional years as the non-metro does.
Okay, so for the historically underutilized business zones, as you shared with us, it can cover a wide range of areas, and it's not necessarily located in any one given area. So that's important for our listeners to basically take away from this. So you could possibly qualify and be in a hub zone. How does a business get certified? How do they go about doing that?
Sure, thank you. Thank you for asking that. Well, first of all, a business, first, like when they got established, they need to look around to see, is there a market for my business? Does the federal government buy what I'm selling, whether a service or a product? Once they determine, maybe they're already doing business with the federal government, but they're seeing that their competition has increased, or maybe they want to decrease their competition. So they're looking at HubZone Citizize and say, my goodness, you know, back in 2011, the federal government awarded almost $10 billion to HubZone businesses. So they're looking at that and saying, well, you know, that's an extra pot of money there that I can go after, and I have the capability to do that. So first of all, they look at their market. Can I actually market myself successfully? Then second of all, they need to take a look at, is my principal office in a HubZone? And the principal office under the HubZone regulations mean that that is the place where the majority of my employees work at. It does not mean that that is my headquarters. It does not mean that that is my branch or anything like that. It could be my branch office. I could have a headquarters, for example, in the middle of downtown San Francisco in a very pricey area, not a HubZone, but that's my headquarters. That's where really the president works, the vice president, secretary, maybe a couple of admin support. But let's say that I have a very significant construction company, and I have this other satellite office where I have the bulk of my employees. My supervisors work there, my assessors work there, absolutely all the people, the support people for the people that work in this field work out of. So what I need to do is look at my situation and figure out where are my offices, my permanent offices located, and which one has the greatest number of the employees. Excluding those that are working on job sites, because obviously if I'm in construction, I'm not going to count my employees that are on job sites for the purpose of that principal office. Once I determine that I have an office with the greatest number of employees that is in a HubZone, and I can go to my to the SBA website to determine that, once I determine that, then I move into my employees. So if I have 100 employees, whether they work in the field, job sites, or in these offices that I have, it doesn't matter. I have to look at my entire workforce, and I need to take a look at where they live. And so I look at where they live, and let's say that I have 100 employees. And if I have at least 35 of those employees that live in HubZones, then I meet that particular requirement. Now, the employee is very important to make sure that I remember what SBA defines as employee under the HubZone program is someone that works at least 40 hours in any given month. Okay, so that's very doable. So let's say that I have some part-timers. Those are still counted as employees so long as I pay them. If I have somebody that I'm not paying that is working contingent on me getting, you know, a particular contract, that person, whether that person works 40 hours a month or 300 hours a month, it does not count because they're considered volunteers. And an owner, whether the owner gets paid or not, will be considered an employee so long as that owner works at least 40 hours a month. And as we know, owners usually work a lot more than 40 hours a month. So those are the first two requirements. The other two requirements are fairly easy for most businesses to achieve because they need to be small under the particular codes, industrial codes, NAICS codes. So for construction, you're finding that construction is revenue-based, and depending on which industry, it ranges, it can be as high as sometimes $13 million or so, the average annual receipts over the last 3 years. So it needs to fall below, obviously, the size standard for that particular NAICS code. And then I need to make sure that my business is owned and controlled directly by a U.S. citizen. So I need to, if I have a corporation, I need to own it directly. My stocks need to say Mariana Pardo, you know. They cannot say Mariana Pardo, Inc., because that's a corporation. They need to be owned by me as a person. And now the other, at least 51%, the other 49% can be owned by a foreign company, by anybody else, okay? But at least 51% need to be owned by a person who is a U.S. citizen. And that's basically, those are the main requirements of the program.
Thank you, Mariana. That is our show for today. The National Association of Black Women in Construction thanks you for listening. And you can go to NABWIC.org to find out additional information on membership and also the different things that NABWIC is up to. Just a reminder, this show is archived at NABWIC.org, NABWIC.org, if you wanted to take a listen in the future. So we hope everyone has a wonderful day.